Hey, it's Jonquilin. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to talk about a podcast survey we're running right now. If you have a few minutes, we'd super appreciate it if you go to vox.com/podcast survey and answer some questions so that we can continue to bring you the content you want to hear. That's vox.com/podcast survey. And the link is also in the show notes. It really helps us out. Thanks. It's the Weeds. I'm Jonquilin Hill. And since the Supreme Court made its decision in Dobbs, overturning Roe v. Wade and the right to an abortion, reproductive rights have been at the center of our national consciousness. Two of the latest headlines come out of Arizona and Florida.
A historic ruling just handed down from the Arizona Supreme Court on abortion access in our state. The justices ruling...
Florida Supreme Court ruled the state's constitution does not protect abortion rights. The ruling allows a trigger law to go into effect in 30 days.
The Florida Supreme Court ruled that a six-week ban gets the go-ahead. Now, that's not really surprising news. Lots of states have rolled back abortion rights in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning Roe. But something in the Florida state constitution makes this decision particularly interesting.
So Florida has this provision in its constitution which says that every natural person has the right to be let alone and free from government intrusion into the person's private life.
Article 1, Section 23 of the Florida State Constitution guarantees a right of privacy. And until the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, abortion had long been considered a private issue. Arizona has similar language in its constitution. It says, quote, "No person shall be disturbed in his private affairs or his home invaded without authority of law." Despite this language, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that an 1864 law that makes abortion illegal, except in the case to save the life of the mother, can take effect. That news broke while we were finishing up this very episode. Now, there are differences in the context for the language in these state constitutions. The language in the Arizona state constitution came long before Roe, and Florida's was added post-Roe. While they're different, they have one thing in common. Neither state's Supreme Court found it sufficient to protect the right to abortion. And all of this is evidence that Dobbs has shifted the very concept of privacy in the U.S. And that has us asking, do we still have a right to privacy? That's the question I posed to my colleague Ian Millhiser. He's a senior correspondent here at Vox, where he covers the Supreme Court. He's been spending a lot of time thinking about this lately.
So let's talk about what the right to privacy is. This is something that developed really over the course of almost an entire century of various Supreme Court decisions. The idea behind a right to privacy is that there are certain parts of our lives that are private, that the government does not get to decide for us, that we, you know, decide for ourselves after talking to our own families, after praying to our own gods. And these are decisions like, do I want to have a child? Who should I marry? Who are my sexual partners going to be? How am I going to raise my children? You know, all of these questions, the Supreme Court said over the course of many years, are just not decisions that the government gets to make for you. These are decisions you make for yourself. One of the important components of the right to privacy is, am I going to have a child? When am I going to have a child? So wrapped up in that was the right to contraception and the right to an abortion. When the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, when it abolished the constitutional right to an abortion, it claimed that this was an abortion-only decision. You know, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion where he said, I'm not coming after any of the other privacy rights. I'm not coming after the right to marry. I'm not coming after the right to contraception. And I guess the question is, how much can we trust these guys? And so the answer to your question, you know, do we still have a right to privacy, is we don't know. The constitutional rights are only as good as the personnel that sit on the courts.
Yeah, I wonder, like, is the right to privacy? It seems like it's literally all about the sexy stuff, it seems like. Like, it's either gender or sex or marriage. Like, it seems like it concentrates on these specific parts of our lives.
A lot of it is sexy stuff. It's not all sexy stuff. But I think that if there is a unifying theory, it does tend to be stuff about the family.
Mm.
even sexuality. I mean, the idea is that, you know, when you have a sex partner, they are auditioning to become a member, to become a member of your family. Right. Exactly. You know, and then when you have sex, there's the potential for creating children. So, you know, that is also tied up in the notion of the family. So, like, there is this idea that, you know, the way that the United States government is set up, you have the federal government and Congress is responsible for some things. You have state governments and they are responsible for other things. And I think the family was thought of as another zone of autonomy, where there's some things that just don't belong to the government at all. They are family decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you raise your children, your sexuality, whether you use contraception, whether you're going to have a child at a particular moment, all of that got roped into this broader concept that we now call the right to privacy.
What other amendments intersect with this right to privacy? Where, what are these tea leaves people are reading to, you know, gather the fact that we have this right out of the Constitution?
So the Constitution is a shockingly vague document. And so, like, one reason why there's such this a continuing, I mean, not just about the right to privacy, but, like, should we recognize unenumerated rights? What are the unenumerated rights? So the 14th Amendment doesn't just refer to liberty. It doesn't just refer to equal protection. It has a provision saying that no citizen shall be denied the privileges or immunities of citizenship. Do you know what the privileges or immunities of citizenship are?
No.
No, neither do I. Neither does the Supreme Court. Like, it's not defined.
I'm just like, I pay taxes. I get to pay taxes. That's my...
Yeah, it's not a defined term. And, like, what the court has said about it is pretty ridiculous. Like, they basically eliminated the privileges and immunities of citizenship in a case called Slaughterhouse in, like, the 1870s.
So that's a great name.
It is a great name. It is a fascinating and, like, really depressing decision we could do a whole other episode on. And then, you know, there's the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration of specific rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to disparage other rights. So here you have a whole amendment that's just saying there are unenumerated rights. We're not going to tell you what they are, but they exist. And the courts aren't allowed to say that they don't exist. And so you have this problem created by the fact that you have a Constitution that's really, really clear that there are some rights out there that are protected by the Constitution that are unenumerated and aren't mentioned. And we're just going to let the courts figure it out. And then it gives the courts basically no guidance on what those rights are. And so, you know, in practice, I think what has happened is that the court is a political body made up of political appointees. If a political party that supports abortion rights is able to hold on to power long enough that it's able to appoint a majority of the justices, then we have a right to an abortion. And if a political party that does not support abortion rights is able to hold on to political power long enough that it can appoint a majority of the justices, then we don't have a right to abortion. And I mean, that's all that there is. I think that's how this works in practice. And I don't even know that that's an unfair system if we didn't have things like, you know, the Electoral College and, you know, the ballot portion Senate, which gives Republicans an advantage. Donald Trump lost the popular vote in 2016. You know, if it wasn't for that, I even kind of say that's a fair way of dealing with the fact that there are all these unenumerated rights. We don't know what they are. But, you know, the Constitution just doesn't give us very much guidance on which rights are protected by it.
Up next, we'll go back in time and look at the cases that have shaped privacy rights and how they're just kind of made up. Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Burrow. Okay, are you ready for the understatement of the century? Buying furniture can be frustrating. You end up visiting a bunch of stores searching aimlessly for the right pieces to match your home, then spend hours trying to get those pieces together, or together again if you got it wrong the first time. And that's even if you were able to get it through the door. Burrow is a furniture company that wants to make the whole thing easier. Burrow's new Dune line features a contemporary yet timeless look inspired by the craftsmanship of classic mid-century construction. If you're looking to bring a sense of luxury, comfort, and durability to your outdoor spaces, you might want to consider Burrow. Like all of Burrow's pieces, they offer easy assembly and disassembly so you can move or store them away as needed. Not only that, they ship straight to your door for free. Listeners of The Weeds can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/weeds. That's Burrow. burrow.com/weeds for 15% off. burrow.com/weeds. Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. Finding the time to exercise can be hard. But with the Hydro Rower, finding time for a 20-minute full-body workout can be a piece of cake. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Hydro caters to all fitness levels, and their classes are taught by Olympians and world-class athletes alike. Eric Maxwell, from the business side of things here at Vox, got to try it out. Here's what he thought.
The Hydro definitely felt like a nice workout. It felt challenging, intuitive, it kind of felt natural without being too strenuous. It was just nice to have a menu of options to find something super customized and just make it feel fun.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS. All right. So what is the first court case in which privacy is the central question?
There have been essentially three waves of Supreme Court decisions that we now think of as right to privacy decisions, although the earliest cases didn't use that term. So the earliest cases are two cases from the 1920s called Mayer v. Nebraska and Pierce v. Society of Sisters. And these cases dealt with essentially the right to choose how to raise your children. Mayer was a case where Nebraska passed a law that forbade school teachers from teaching students in a language other than English. And there was a school teacher who was charged with a crime because the teacher taught the German language. And like that was a crime in Nebraska. If that case had come up today, that would have probably been struck down on First Amendment grounds. I mean, obviously, free speech means you can teach someone to speak German, but the court instead saw this as part of a right to choose the upbringing of your children. And if you want your children to learn the German language, you can send them to school where they learn the German language. Pierce was a similar case. This was an Oregon law that it targeted all private schools, but the real target was parochial schools. It was an attempt to ban Catholic parents from sending their kids to Catholic schools. And the court struck that down. You know, if that case came up today, it would have been struck down under the free exercise clause of the Constitution, the provision saying that you have a right to exercise your religion. But the court in the 1920s saw this as a part of this right to raise your children. And then that was the first wave of what we now think of as right to privacy decision.
Yeah. And that's really interesting, especially in the context of now when you're thinking about the current parental rights movement we're seeing in a lot of states.
Yeah. No, the interesting thing about the early right to privacy cases being about the right to raise your children is you're seeing a divide within social conservatives and within the Christian right about what they think about the right to privacy. Because in the second wave of right to privacy cases, these started to sweep in not just the right to, you know, choose how you raise your children, but the right to decide whether or not to have children at all. And so, you know, the second wave of decisions, that's Griswold, the 1965 decision involving contraception. There were a few other contraception decisions that followed that. And then Roe v. Wade in 1973, these are right to choose whether or not to have children cases.
Yeah. Can you talk about Griswold v. Connecticut? You know, we've talked about it on the show before, but give us a refresher. Like, what was that case and why is it important?
Griswold is an odd decision. I think to understand Griswold, you have to understand like what happened in like the 30 or 40 years prior to Griswold. The 1920s cases, Mayer and Brown, if they had been decided today, they would have been decided under the First Amendment. They would have been decided under an explicit, what's called an enumerated right that is like written into the Constitution. Instead, the court invented this right that is not mentioned in the Constitution, the, you know, the right to decide how to raise your children. And that's just how courts operated in the 1920s. You know, this was what was called the Lochner era. Lochner said that there is a so-called right to contract. And what the right to contract was the right to enter into a labor contract where you're paid terrible wages and you work ridiculously long hours. You know, it was a right of employers to exploit their workers. That's not mentioned in the Constitution either.
A right to a job that sucks. Okay.
Yeah, right to a job that sucks. That was essentially what the right was that was created in Lochner. And during the New Deal, this idea that courts should be finding unenumerated rights was discredited. And it was discredited, you know, because of Lochner, you know, because of these hot, very anti-worker decisions that the court had handed down. And so Griswold is a weird decision because they want to recognize a right to contraception, but they want to make it look as little like Lochner as possible. So they have this sort of tenuous reasoning that like, well, the Constitution protects these other things that deal with privacy, you know, protects you against the police searching your home without a warrant. And so the language that the court used was penumbras and emanations. Somewhere within the penumbras and emanations of these existing enumerated right to privacy is a broader right to contraception. There was a theory behind that. You know, the theory was that if it's a crime to have contraceptions, if it's a crime to use birth control, if it's a crime to use a condom, then the police can search your bedroom or can search a married couple's bedroom for evidence of like illicit condom use, for evidence of like, ooh, you've got an illicit diaphragm in there. We're going to have to throw you in jail.
Yeah, I'm just like imagining a scenario where they're like, I need to check for an IUD. And I'm like, that sounds terrible. No.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was what the court wanted to prevent, was the idea was the sort of police investigation that would have to go on in order to determine that you were violating a contraception ban would be so offensive. Think about modern forms of contraception and like the sort of search that the police would have to do in order to determine that you're using it. And so Griswold, you know, the insight was that there's something so offensive about the police being able to make this kind of investigation that we're just going to take it off the table. And that was how sexuality sort of got wrapped into this right to privacy.
Yeah, I think this issue of privacy, you know, you name all these instances, like, you know, we have contraception, we have same-sex marriage, we have same-sex sex, sex outside of marriage, gender-affirming care, all these different forms of health care. And I think this issue of privacy is most well-known in the Roe v. Wade case. And when she was alive, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was very critical of the right to privacy being the reasoning behind the Roe decision. Can you talk about what her argument was?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I mean, she was obviously a very significant judge, but probably the most significant impact she had on the law was before she became a judge. You know, when she was still a lawyer, she was a very important feminist civil rights lawyer in the 1970s. And there's a provision of the Constitution that says no one shall be denied the equal protection of the laws. that has traditionally been thought of as something that prevents race discrimination, and like certainly the history of it, like it's part of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was essentially the treaty that between the North and the South that ended the Civil War. And I mean, that was a war about slavery. So it makes sense that we think of this as a race provision. But it's broadly worded. It says no one shall be denied the equal protection of the law. Not just, you know, Black people won't be denied, or, you know, people of a certain race won't be denied. And so Justice Ginsburg's insight was, this is something that should apply to types of discrimination that are similar in character to racism. Sexism is similar in character to racism in that, you know, it is irrational. It judges people based on traits that don't have anything to do with their ability to contribute to society. These are just arbitrary prejudice that we've held on to for a very long time. And the Constitution should also protect against that kind of thing. And she successfully convinced the Supreme Court that the 14th Amendment should be read not just to protect against race discrimination, but also to protect against sex discrimination. And she saw the contraceptive right and the abortion right as part of that broad project. You know, the idea was that a woman cannot thrive in society. They cannot, you know, achieve the same professional heights. They cannot compete in the workplace if they are constantly under threat of being taken out of the workforce for 9 months at a time or more because they're pregnant, that they need to be able to control that aspect of their life if they are going to have equality in society. And, you know, personally, I find that argument more persuasive than the right to privacy argument. I think the contraceptive and abortive rights, they make more sense if you think of them as feminist rights. I think that, you know, hews more closely to the text of the Constitution. I also think it leads to a less freewheeling judicial power where judges are just inventing rights on the fly. But that's sort of the dog that did not bark in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, because the most important feminist legal decision was Craig v. Boren in the mid-1970s. It was 2 or 3 years after Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. So the Supreme Court had not yet embraced that language of equality that Justice Ginsburg advocated for when Roe v. Wade was handed down. And so that whole line, the right to privacy jurisprudence, sort of developed independently of the feminist jurisprudence.
We've gotten into how people raise kids. We've gotten to, you know, people choosing to or not to have kids. But marriage is also a big one here. Can we talk about Loving v. Virginia and Obergefell and kind of what those did and where those stand right now?
So as the right to privacy developed, you know, again, the first decisions were just about a right to raise your kids. The second wave of decisions, you know, decisions like Griswold and Roe, were about a right to decide whether or not to have kids at all. Then, I mean, Loving v. Virginia was in the 1960s, so, you know, this was the earliest expansion into marriage. But Loving v. Virginia said that you have a right to marry a person of your own choosing, regardless of what race they are. Obergefell said that you have a right to marry a person of your own choosing, regardless of what gender they are. And then, you know, and the other big right to privacy case that I haven't mentioned was Lawrence v. Texas, which was, I mean, it was a case about two men who were arrested for having gay sex, but it is much bigger than just a right to have sex with a person of the same sex. It is a right to have consensual non-commercial sex. So it doesn't include the right to hire a sex worker, but the right to have consensual non-commercial sex with any consenting adult of your choice. The idea was that sexuality, the family, children, the way that they are brought up, all of this is something that the government shouldn't be deciding. All of this is stuff that is private. It is personal to us. We make these decisions ourselves. That is how the right to privacy has developed. And, it developed over time. It was an iterative process. You know, I think that the court saw that they had developed a right to sexuality through cases like Griswold and Roe. And so it made sense that Lawrence would encompass a broader right to sexuality. You know, they saw that they had recognized a right to marriage and Loving. So it made sense to have a broader right to marriage in Obergefell. But how this developed was the court trying to make sense of what it had said in the past about, okay, what are these things that we have walled off from the government that are personal? And, you know, what should be the scope of this zone of personal autonomy?
Are there any pending cases where privacy is a central issue right now? I'm, you know, in particular, I'm thinking about trans healthcare.
There are many cases focusing on transgender rights. And oddly enough, the right to privacy is coming into play from both directions here.
Mm.
So the pro-trans rights argument is that, look, you have all these states that have passed laws banning trans healthcare for minors, you know, saying that you can't have puberty blockers or gender-affirming care if you're under the age of 18. And if we recognize a right to choose how you raise your children, and we have recognized in the past that the right to privacy includes a certain extent of medical privacy, you know, the right to use contraception, the right to use abortion, then if I have a daughter who I thought was my son, and the doctor comes to me and says, your child has gender dysphoria, and we have a treatment for gender dysphoria, you as a parent need to decide whether or not this child should have this treatment. I mean, that looks a lot like a right to decide how your child is brought up case. That looks like a lot like a right to medical privacy case. And so trans rights groups are arguing that, look, if you take Mayer seriously, if you take Pierce seriously, if you take Griswold seriously, then there also has to be a right to choose that your child with gender dysphoria is going to get what you, in consultation with your doctor, deem to be the appropriate medical treatment. So that's the pro-trans version of the right to privacy argument. The anti-trans version, this is being pioneered by an organization called the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is this big Christian right law firm that, you know, argues a whole lot of anti-LGBTQ cases. And they have argued in court that school districts that have trans-inclusive bathroom policies are violating the Constitution because cisgender students have a privacy right to go to the bathroom in a space where there is not someone who was assigned a different sex at birth.
Mm.
You know, the idea is that the bathroom is itself a private space, or the locker room is itself a private space. And if someone with a different sex assigned at birth is present in that space, that somehow violates the right to privacy. It is easy to see how the right to privacy, you know, how cases like Mayer and Pierce that talk about a right to choose how to raise your children could be used to justify things like the book bans that we're seeing in states like Florida. You know, I want to choose how to raise my children. I want to choose how my child learns about the concept of homosexuality. And if there's a book in the school library that introduces them to that concept before I want my child to learn about it, that violates my right to choose how my child is brought up. So this privacy right is a weapon that can be used by both sides. And, you know, we are seeing in the actual litigation that's going on right now that it is a weapon that is being used by both sides.
So we know where we are with privacy. After the break, where are we going?
This week on The Pitch, we're back to pitches. And this one's coming from my job.
What Podcast AI does is it lets podcast producers become 10 times more productive.
How much are you charging The Pitch?
We're charging $99. And Josh came in right before we doubled our prices.
Mm-hmm.
What's keeping something like a Restream from just going like, yep, we do all this AI now stuff too?
So there's a lot of these older companies that are tacking on AI,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of the issue. They're tacking it on.
You built this really quickly. What's to stop anybody else from doing this? What's the moat?
How do you build a moat when you're building with AI? That's this week on The Pitch. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, Ian, we're talking about privacy for a lot of reasons, but a big one that we have not touched on, almost an elephant in the room, is Justice Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion in the Dobbs case. Remind us of what he said and why it rang alarm bells for a lot of these cases.
So there were two important concurring opinions in the Dobbs case. One was Justice Thomas's opinion. And Thomas's opinion, which I will point out, was joined by no other justice. That doesn't mean that none of the other justices agree with him. They didn't decide to go public at this time. Yeah. Essentially said this whole right to privacy is bullshit. We should get rid of it. And that means we should get rid not just of the abortion right, but of Griswold and the contraception right, of Lawrence and the right to sexuality, of Obergefell and the right to choose who you marry. All of this should be gone. If the government wants to decide who you're going to marry, then the government can decide who you're going to marry. If the government wants to ban IUDs, the government can ban IUDs. That was Justice Thomas's view. The other important concurrence was Brett Kavanaugh. And, you know, we normally do not think of Brett Kavanaugh as an important feminist figure, but he at least drew a boundary around the project that the court was up to in Dobbs. And he said, look, abortion is unique. The court should not be involved in deciding abortion policy, but I am not coming for all the other privacy rights. I'm not coming for Obergefell. I am not coming for Griswold. That is what Justice Kavanaugh said. No one joined Justice Kavanaugh's decision either, so we don't know which justices agree with Kavanaugh. We don't know which justices agree with Thomas. The fact that Brett Kavanaugh said this, I think, gives those of us who care about things, like who don't want to live in a country where contraception is banned or where, like, the government can prevent you from marrying who you want, you know, I think it gives us some temporary hope. Because, you know, it's going to be hard to count to 5 votes for any of the outcomes that Justice Thomas wants if he doesn't have Kavanaugh's vote. There probably aren't 5 votes to nuke the whole right to privacy right now.
Something that's so interesting about the Thomas concurring opinion is that he name-checked Obergefell and all these other cases. He did not check Loving.
He did not, no.
He did not mention that.
Well, I'll just say that Clarence Thomas is someone who has personally benefited from the right to interracial marriage that was recognized in Loving. And, you know, good for him. You know, I agree with Loving v. Virginia that people should be able to marry whoever they choose. But, you know, it is interesting.
Yeah, it's just like name-checking all these, but not that one. I'm like, huh, that's an interesting omission. Yeah.
I mean, in fairness, Loving can be justified 2 ways. Loving was not just a right to privacy decision. It was also an equal protection decision because, you know, denying someone the right to marry a person because of their race doesn't just violate the right to privacy. It violates the right to be free from race discrimination. Mm. And so there is like a coherent legal justification for how you can support eliminating the right to privacy and still think that Loving v. Virginia was correctly decided.
Yeah. And I guess that goes back to RBG's argument about, like, no, this is about gender discrimination versus right to privacy.
Exactly. And this is why, you know, again, if I were to do this from scratch, I think that Justice Ginsburg is correct that, like, the feminist right, you know, the right to be free from gender discrimination, like that is a better source of rights like the right to contraception and the right to abortion than this right to privacy, which, again, I mean, like it's developed over 100 years. It's not like this came from nowhere, but that came from an iterative process of the court exercising its own authority, relying on very vague provisions of the Constitution.
And you wrote this piece about the right to privacy, and in it, you end it with these 4 different ways that this can play out. It, almost like a choose your own adventure, except we don't actually get to choose. There are 9 people in black robes that get to do it for us. But what are those scenarios and how would we get there?
I mean, I will say we do get to choose. Mm-hmm. All of this is going to be decided potentially by the next election. Mm-hmm. And certainly by like upcoming elections. So, you know, one possibility is that Justice Thomas wins and the right to privacy ceases to exist. You know, no more contraceptive right, no more right to marry the person you, you know, the government could potentially throw you in jail because they don't like who you're having sex with in that world. And that's not going to happen now. I mean, Kavanaugh said he's not going to vote for it. But if Donald Trump is elected and he puts more Clarence Thomases on the Supreme Court, you know, we could very easily be in that world. I mean, this is going to be decided by this election. There's 2 different versions of if Kavanaugh's view prevails. So, like, if we keep the Supreme Court we have forever. And like Brett Kavanaugh is the king of America. Everything depends on what Brett Kavanaugh believes. You know, we know that Brett Kavanaugh has said that he will not, with the exception of abortion, roll back existing rights that the court has already said is part of the right to privacy. So he's not going to overrule Griswold. He's not going to overrule Lawrence. But the court has not said that a right to gender-affirming care is implicit in the right to privacy. And we just don't know where Brett Kavanaugh is going to fall on that. You know, given that he is a conservative Republican, I'm not optimistic that what he thinks is going to be good for trans rights. But, you know, I want to analyze him in a journalistically rigorous way. I have my suspicions about what he thinks about this issue, but we don't know yet. And then the fourth possibility is, you know, I mentioned that there are Christian right groups that want to use the right to privacy to achieve their own goals. So, you know, it is entirely possible that if Trump wins, he could just appoint a bunch of hacks to the Supreme Court. And the right to privacy becomes a weapon that's used to, say, target trans-inclusive bathroom policies. Mm. I should mention there's a fifth possibility that I didn't discuss in my piece. The fifth possibility is that Biden wins. Mm. And if Biden wins, you know, he could potentially replace Thomas and Alito. And then we have Roe v. Wade back. Then we have the full bore right to privacy back in place. So, you know, again, if I have one central message in this entire interview, it's that what the Constitution says does not matter. The right to privacy comes from the vaguest provisions of the Constitution. You know, if you look at what just happened in Florida, there's no doubt that Florida's privacy amendment, which is much more specific than what's in the U.S. Constitution, was enacted to codify Roe v. Wade. But there's a Republican court in Florida, and so that right doesn't exist anymore. All of this depends on judicial appointments. And at the federal level, judicial appointments are made by the president. So, you know, the future of the right to privacy is going to be decided potentially forever in the next election, and certainly in elections moving forward. You know, who picks the justices will decide whether this right remains robust and whether it remains a right that we recognize as the right to privacy that we have today, or whether it becomes a weapon that's used by the Christian right.
It's just all so vague and unpredictable. And I realize it would be very idealistic and probably more than a little bit naive to like expect something like, oh, let's get a constitutional amendment that says these things explicitly and codifies this right to privacy. And, you know, right now it is up to the interpretation of the Supreme Court. And clearly the makeup of that court changes over time. Like, you know, we have our eyes on 2024, but there will be a 2028 and a so on and so forth until, you know, Lord knows what happens. But what options do we have to make it a little more predictable? Like, can it be, or is this sort of just the nature of the Constitution, the nature of the country? Like, there are just some things that will kind of always be up in the air depending on who's in power.
I think one of the biggest lessons from the post-Trump Supreme Court is that the Constitution means whatever five justices say it means. You know, we didn't lose Roe v. Wade because anything changed in the Constitution itself. The document we have now is virtually identical to the document we had when Roe was handed down. What changed was the membership of the Supreme Court. And that has two big implications. The first big implication is that politics still matters. If Joe Biden is elected in 2024, he can appoint different justices, and those different justices can give us back Roe v. Wade. Even if he's not elected, you know, one thing that we're seeing right now that's a little surprising is that the Republicans are sort of the dog that caught the car when it comes to abortion. In Alabama, the state Supreme Court tried to ban IVF, and approximately 5 minutes later, the Republican state legislature passed a law overturning that because Republicans realized just how horribly unpopular it is. Donald Trump just put out a statement where he sort of hems and haws and says, I'm very proud that I appointed the justice who overruled Roe v. Wade, but also this is a state issue now. I don't want Congress to do anything. And, you know, he said that because he knows that the Republican Party's position on abortion is unpopular and he's unlikely to get elected if he says what they have historically said about abortion. Now, that said, I think that we should be very cautious because, again, the Constitution says whatever five justices say it means. It doesn't matter if Donald Trump is going to sign a law banning abortions. What matters if he is going to appoint justices who will ban abortions. So we are in this period where everything is in flux. The Republican Party is running scared. They don't want to do things in the honest way and pass a law banning abortion, but they might be willing to do it in a more underhanded way and appoint justices who will ban abortion that way.
Privacy is something I think about a lot. And before this conversation, it was typically not within the scope of abortion. It's not lost on me that we're constantly surveilled. From cameras to cookies, our movements aren't hard to track. And as this legal back and forth unfolds, we'll likely see questions arise around the many different ways privacy shows up in our lives. That's all for us today. Thank you to Ian Millhiser for joining me. Our producer is Sophie Lalonde. Patrick Boyd engineered this episode. Melissa Hirsch fact-checked it. Our editorial director is A.M. Hall. And I'm your host, Jonquilin Hill. This podcast is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep it that way by going to vox.com/give.
Let me wait for Watson to stop barking. And
oh,
then,
Watson, yeah. He's such a big boy.
He is very large and has very strong thoughts about the right to privacy.